Today's episode is brought to you by the new comedy web series, Howard's Hot Roommate. What if your new roommate was the woman of your dreams? Would you be cool? Not Howard. Would you be tough? Not Howard. Would you be sexy? Definitely not Howard. You have to check out this new web series, Howard's Hot Roommate. It was created and written by Earwolf's very own John Cohen. John works here at Midroll Media on the content partnership team. He's a great guy, and watching this web series is a way to not only support him, but also support our company because we love John. The web series is really hilarious. If you love Curb Your Enthusiasm, you love Seinfeld, it's that kind of humor. And what I love about it is the episodes are really short too. I have a packed calendar, like probably a lot of people who listen to this show. And when I'm on a call that's supposed to be an hour long and it ends maybe at 56 minutes in, I'm usually wondering what I'm going to do for the next 4 minutes. And what I've been doing is watching this series. And the episodes are like 2, 3, 4 minutes long, and they are great. They're super entertaining, really funny. I find myself laughing out loud at my desk. I strongly recommend you check out this series. You can check out all 6 episodes of Howard's Misadventures now at meethoward.com. That's meethoward.com. Today's episode is also brought to you by Podcast Movement. Podcast Movement is the world's largest gathering of podcasters and people involved in the podcast industry, taking place this July in Chicago. It's an awesome event, and this year we'll host over 1,500 attendees from around the world. Featured speakers include past Wolf Den guest Alex Bloomberg from Gimlet, Anna Sale from WNYC's Death, Sex, and Money, Glenn Washington of Snap Judgment, Tracy in Heaven from Another Round, and more are being announced every week. To see the full lineup and to register, visit podcastmovement.com and use the code WOLF, W-O-L-F, to save $50 off the cost of registration. How about that new music? Huge shout out to engineer Cody Brett for creating a new theme for the show. I went to Brett explaining that I really thought the show needed new music. We were sitting in my office and he was looking around for some inspiration, asking me what I wanted. And of course he saw the huge framed photo of Bruce Springsteen hanging on my wall. So I think that was part of the inspiration. This was also around the time of David Bowie's passing, so I think that served as some inspiration for Brett too. Anyway, I think it's awesome. Thanks, Brett. And frankly, the rest is Wolf Den history. Speaking of Wolf Den history, welcome to episode 100 of The Wolf Den. I'm Adam Sachs, CEO of Midroll Media and host of the show. To be clear, this isn't my 100th episode. I took over at episode 61. But still, I'm thrilled that the show and I could make it to this milestone, and I'm looking forward to the shows yet to come. If you haven't yet listened to the last episode, number 99, I strongly encourage you to do so. In that episode, I take a listen back to the last 6 years of this show, which also charts the evolution of Earwolf, Midroll, and frankly, the podcasting industry. Once more, I want to thank the unsung hero of this show, my producer, Paul Rees-Mendel, who did an awesome job in compiling episode 99, and who really helps make my job as a host a whole lot easier. For number 100, I wanted a guest who has had tremendous influence on the radio and podcasting landscape. So for today's show, I'm happy to have a guest whose work I greatly admire and who is a true innovator in the space. That person is Jad Abumrad. Jad is the creator and co-host of the public radio program and podcast, Radiolab. Founded in 2005 at WNYC in New York City, Radiolab is heard on more than 500 public radio stations, and the podcast is perennially at the top of the iTunes charts. The show has received 2 Peabody Awards, and Jad was named a MacArthur Fellow in 2011. He has also reported and produced for shows like On the Media, Studio 360, Morning Edition, and All Things Considered. I talked with Jad just before I recorded episode 99. Our conversation also covers the evolution of podcasting, and Jad comments on both how Radiolab has changed and on how the industry can continue to grow and cultivate fresh talent. Here's my conversation with Jad. Jad, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
To get started, you know, for listeners who perhaps unbelievably have never heard of Radiolab, would you mind describing the show?
Oh boy, that's always a hard one for me. I should probably have it down by now. I've yet in the 12, 13 years we've been doing this to have like the elevator pitch, but essentially it's a show. It's like two guys in a 12-dimensional diner talking about complex things. And it's the two guys are Robert and me, and we will set our sights on some complicated topic or question or idea, And we will like just kind of talk our way through it. And in this 12-dimensional diner, there are sometimes scientists at the tables adjoining us that we can turn to. There are sometimes philosophers, politics, politicians. You know, I would have called it maybe 5 or 6 years ago a science show, but we've since broadened and now we're doing international politics, sports. It's a big, lovely, confusing jumble at the moment. But the only sort of through lines are that usually the ideas are big, the stories are dramatic, and it's like, you know, we just try and go on a joyride and talk our way through it.
And how has the show evolved since, you know, it started in 2005, I think, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on where you peg the beginning. I mean, the beginning was earlier than that. It was just me in sort of a basement, basically putting together different documentaries and talking my way between them. But, you know, 2005-ish, that's when Robert and I really sort of started doing it together. I guess that's probably the formal beginning. And it's evolved in that, I mean, the sound of it was there pretty early. Like, it always sounded very kind of hi-fi, lots of layers, lots of sounds and music. Our choice of topics is, I mean, we started doing these sort of like big umbrella topics called time and space. and then you'd get like little vignettes, like the Time Hour would have vignettes about astrophysics meets like Beethoven, like what happens when you slow Beethoven down 24 hours. And we'd go to Berlin where a bunch of people are listening to this Beethoven thing slowed down to where it lasts 24 hours. And then you'd go from that to like a hummingbird. How does a hummingbird experience time? And then you'd go over to that for like a whale. How does a whale experience time? And it was all these like little disorienting jumps from one vignette to the other. Mm-hmm. We've since sort of evolved to now where like our topics are like longer and bigger. We're doing like 45-minute, hour, 2 hour documentaries on all manner of stuff. You know, everything from like the legal foundation to the war on terror, to like the history of American football, to we just did a thing about this species of beetles that have like a that's called they called it the Death Watch beetle.
Yeah,
and how
the
do they
Death
mate?
Watch yeah, that guy in the UK, right? Who?
Yeah, like, totally. So there's that. I mean, we're actually a real sort of bouquet of different topics and moods, but generally things have gotten longer and more complicated as we've evolved.
And has the production changed?
Yeah, I mean, the production was always, maybe we slowed down a little bit. I mean, it's a show that was always trying to do editing differently and like use music differently. And so I think we came out of the gate and we were doing things with music and sound that I don't think other people are doing. But over the years, we've sort of scaled it back a little bit and the scoring has become a little bit more subtle, I think. Mm-hmm. But still, it's like it's always been a show that's trying to move at the speed of life. You know, it's not trying to sort of get into that slow public radio kind of meter. It's trying to do something that's a little faster and a little more kinetic.
And what does the show do for you personally? And you know, clearly you're a creative person. Why is it that this is your chosen outlet?
I don't know. I mean, it's like I can wake up in the morning and define it as I go. It feels like a real awesome gift in a way. It's like wake up one day and you want to do a story about an ice skater who pioneered the first backflip in women's figure skating. Well, we can do that story and we're doing that story. Mm-hmm. Or on the other hand, you want to do a whole hour on bubbles. We're going to do a whole hour on bubbles. Well, we can do that. It just feels like the rules are constantly changing according to whatever it is we're interested in. And I'm like, wow, how many people get to say that? So I'm really into it just because I can define it however I want to. I mean, obviously now it's with a big team and we all do it together. So it's not just me making these decisions, but it feels very like wide open in a way that's completely amazing.
A few years ago, you gave a talk at 99U that went kind of viral among business and life hacking sites. The title was Why Gut Churn is an Essential Part of the Creative Process. I know you credited Michael Elsesser with using that term to describe your feeling in the early days of Radiolab. Can you describe or explain what gut churn is to you and why you think it's essential as part of the creative process?
Well, that term came because I just to sort of set that up, I had asked Michael, I'd been asked basically by this conference to give a talk about how Radiolab happened. And this was like 9 years into it. Mm-hmm. And I honestly couldn't remember because it was all a blur. And so I called up Michael and I was like, okay, Michael, at the beginning, what do you remember about the beginning? And there was this like maybe 7 second pause. And then he says, gut churn. And that was like, that's what he remembered. That was the most like powerful memory of the beginning. And I remember hearing that and being like, oh yeah, wow, right. That's the story of how this thing happened. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, that beginning state where we all go through it, where like you're really passionate about something, you've got an idea, but you don't know how to do it. There's no template. You don't know which way to go exactly. You've got your instincts, but your instincts aren't really formed yet. And so you're just kind of flailing around in the dark. You're taking these blind alleys that lead nowhere. You're missing deadlines sometimes. You're just trying to make it work and it's not working, but you keep doing it. And then you have these moments where you're like, what am I doing? I need to know what I'm doing. How am I going to pay for this? And you have that. And it's that uncertainty that's at the beginning of any project. That was really very powerful. That was like the story of the first 3 or 4 years of this thing was just feeling that way every single day. And I think it's, and I look back on it and I'm really glad for that. I mean, I hated it at the time.
You think that's a valuable feeling?
Yeah, because it's like it pushes you. When you feel that way is when you know you're not doing the thing that's familiar. Mm-hmm. You're out past your comfort zone, which I think you have to do if you're trying to do something interesting. So now that we're established and we have an audience, I definitely ask myself like, okay, when was the last time I felt that way? And if the answer is too long, then I'm like, okay, we got to do something that hurts a little bit. We have to do something that pushes us out a little bit. And so I actually sort of search out that feeling a little bit now as an indicator that we're doing something interesting.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs, I think, can really relate to that feeling. From your perspective, I imagine there was sort of a mix of, you were feeling that sort of probably partially as an entrepreneur and partially as an artist. Is that right? Would you say that was sort of like were you feeling that because, oh my God, what is this business endeavor that I'm getting myself into? Or were you feeling it more because you were doubting the art itself?
I was just doubting everything. I mean, I don't know that I knew enough to even call it a business at that point. I was literally like Michael, who coined the term, he literally grabbed me out of the hall and was like, let's do this thing. And it starts in 4 days. So I had 4 days to figure out all of these questions. Like I had been doing radio a little bit at that point. Podcasting didn't exist yet. So I had done some radio stories, but I was still super green. And then suddenly in 4 days, I was going to be hosting this show. And it's like, what do you sound like? Who are you when you host a show? Like what is your personality? You know, what stories do you want to play? What stories are yours and what stories aren't yours? How do you want this thing to sound? How are you going to use music? All these questions that I had never thought about. I had 4 days to figure it out. And so I just went into this kind of like sprint that lasted for like 4 years of just trying to figure this stuff out. And it didn't occur to me till like really long in the process that like, okay, this is a business. You're going to have to think about business stuff. And in many ways, that's something I'm learning now, like years and years later. But no, it was mostly about the art. It was mostly just about the nuts and bolts of like hosting and talking into a mic.
Right.
Like how does your voice sound? How far do you need to be from the mic? What's the right way to address your listeners and what's the wrong way? Like all this stuff. None of it was like conscious, but it's all like these questions that you never think to think about until suddenly it's just you and a mic in a studio, you know?
And it sounds like in those days you had a lot of freedom. Because I think, as you put it, like you had virtually no listeners.
You had a lot of questions that had to be answered.
Was that freedom, do you think it was a good thing?
In retrospect, yeah, totally. I mean, at the time, I remember thinking like, why aren't people listening to this? And then I listen back to it. And I'm like, oh God, thank God they weren't listening to it. Because you need, I think of that time as like a period of benign neglect. Mm-hmm. Like you need to be left alone for your own good.
Yeah.
And I kind of was. And also like it just so happened that I was on the AM at night, and the thing about, I would learn this years later, the thing about like AM radio waves is they travel really long distances and they will bounce off the Hudson River and land in Canada. And so the Canadians get really mad at us, and so because it screws up their radio stations. So we are obliged by the FCC to cut the power on our AM at night. And so, which is exactly when I came on. So it's unless you are you were literally hugging the transmitter with your body, you could not get my show. So like no one was listening because they couldn't, you know, like it was literally zero people were listening. And in retrospect, I think that was good. I needed that. I needed to be ignored for a long, long time.
Because it basically gave you this lab where you could really be experimental.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I hope that we'll figure out a way to develop people where it won't take as long as it took me. I hope that like people can just come in, they go through like a set of steps and then they have their podcast and they're successful. It took me a really long time to just get the basics down.
Are there incubator type things today? Do you think that exists for people who want to have a career or want to follow your path and be a producer in public radio?
I don't know. I hope no one follows my path because it took too long. But I don't know. I mean, there's a lot more opportunity, and I think that's good. I do think that like the thing for us as an industry moving forward is how do we train people? Like, where are these people going to come from? And like film has film schools. We don't have that. Mm-hmm. So like where is the training going to happen? And
my major in college was radio, TV, film, and I don't think I took one radio course the whole
exactly,
time.
Exactly. Like no one, it wasn't, because it wasn't a real economy until, no. I don't know that it still is. I mean, it's getting there, mm-hmm. but like, you know, let's just assume that podcasting develops in the way that we all hope. We're going to need people to fill those jobs. And like, I don't know where they are.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know who's training those people. So that's one of our big challenges.
Is it something
I'm not quite sure how I got
on?
Onto this. Did you ask me this question or did I just start talking about it?
I think you talked about it, but I'm interested. Like, is that something that you guys think about at WNYC or at your show specifically? Like, how are we
I think we're
nurturing
all
young
it.
Talent?
I think, I mean, I talked to, you mentioned that you spoke with Alex Bloomberg. I know he's thinking about it. I know we're thinking about it at WNYC. Mm-hmm. I know it's a big question, training the next generation.
So back to your 99U talk, I think one of the reasons that the video was so popular is because it people that are creative can relate to it, but also a lot of entrepreneurs can identify with the types of feelings you were talking about. Do you think of yourself now? I know back then you didn't think about the business necessarily at all, and it sounds like you're much more focused on the art. But right now, today, do you think about yourself as an entrepreneur?
As maybe a little bit. I don't call myself that because then I think of the people who really are entrepreneurs and I'm like, I'm not sure I'm those guys, but yeah, it is more in my mind these days, because of podcasting being where it's at and the amount of attention it's gotten and the amount of opportunities that are around, everybody's taking risks for the first time. Mm-hmm. And that's really exciting. I mean, WNYC Studios is taking all these risks and Gimlet and Midroll and all these companies are doing risky, interesting things. And so it does make you feel a little bit like you're an adventurer. I maybe use that term more than entrepreneur. But mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, the business is this new frontier. Like, how do we support this stuff? And can this industry be profitable? And all those questions. It's definitely more front of mind than it ever has been. So yeah, it's a little bit more in my mind. It's definitely a little bit more.
About 5 years or so ago, you were awarded the MacArthur Fellowship. I'm curious, what has that done for your work? Has it opened doors?
I think so. It definitely, what did it do? God, it's like it was, it put this asterisk next to my name, which was really initially kind of trippy and a bit disorienting, but now kind of great. It made conversations. Here's what it did, basically. Like I've been a person I'm not a terribly confident person for the position that I'm in, but it made me a little more confident and it made it easier for me to talk to people who I really admire.
Because you felt like you had some sort of validation?
A little bit, yeah. A little bit.
That makes sense. Yeah. It's called a genius grant, so maybe the asterisk next to your name is that you're a genius.
Well, that's the part that was a little trippy and then I still like don't. I still don't simultaneously agree with or believe. So that part was a little weird. But the part that's like, wow, people have recognized your work and they're giving you this thing, which means they like what you've done and they want to see what you do coming in the future. That part of it is really amazing. I mean, it's amazing.
And were people perceptibly treating you differently?
Yeah, a little bit, a little bit. For a while, it was this weird thing where people would ask me, "So, how did Radiolab happen?" And they'd give me this look where I'm like, they were expecting some great wisdom to come, and I was like, I don't know, I just made it up, you know. But that was initially disorienting. People expected me to be a whole lot smarter than I actually am. But then that's all gone away. And now I just see it for what it is, which is like, it's a really amazing thing. And it gets me, it opens a few doors that would have otherwise been closed.
Absolutely. Right, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and talk more about podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Podcast Movement. Podcast Movement is the world's largest gathering of podcasters and people involved in the podcast industry, taking place this July in Chicago. Podcast Movement is an awesome event. If you've heard my Wolf Den episode with Mark Maron, you may remember that that episode actually was a live recording of Mark and I on stage doing one of the keynote presentations at Podcast Movement last year. It was a great event. The speaker list last year was really phenomenal. There was Mark Maron, Sarah Koenig, Roman Mars, a few mid-roll staff members were there speaking, like Lex Friedman and Chris Bannon, and I'm sure at least one or two of us will be there talking again this year. But the slate of people is really great. I mean, it includes featured speakers like Alex Bloomberg, Anna Sale, Glenn Washington, Tracy in Heaven from Another Round out of BuzzFeed, and many more are being announced each week. Go see the full lineup and register for podcastmovement.com and use the offer code WOLF at checkout to save $50 off the cost of registration. Today's episode is brought to you by Harry's. Guys, everybody knows good things come in sets of three. What does that have to do with anything? Well, get this. March is the third month of the year. It also happens to be our friends over at Harry's 3-year anniversary as a business. And if you're new to Harry's, I've got a special deal for you to try 3 of their expertly crafted 5-blade German razors, a handle, and shave cream for just $10. I've been a Harry's user for probably 2 years now. I think it's an awesome product. I actually used to use, I've cycled through a bunch of different kinds of razors, but Harry's is the one that I've stuck with. They just make it so easy. They send you the razors every month. And one thing I love about them is it's not one of these subscriptions where one day you check your mail and it's there and you realize you've been charged. They actually send you an email preparing you for the fact that they're going to charge you and going to send you this. So it's totally above board. They make it really easy. In fact, I've actually got my dad to be using Harry's now. I convinced him a long time ago, and he's hooked too. So strongly recommend using it. The quality's great. It's German engineered. They have 5-blade cartridges. They really give you a close, comfortable shave, and their quality is guaranteed. So they'll give you a full refund if you're not happy. The price is great too. You get the factory direct prices. They cut out the middleman. It ships right to your door. They really sell their blades at half the price of the leading brand. Over 1 million guys have already made the switch, and thousands more switch every single day. Harry's is already very much discounted, so they don't like to give additional discounts, but we worked out a special offer for my listeners here. Harry's will give you $5 off your first order with promo code WOLF. Stop overpaying for a great shave. Go to harrys.com right now. That's Harry's, HARRYS.com, and enter code WOLF at checkout to get an additional $5 off. We're back with Jad Abumrad from Radiolab. Jad, I want to move the conversation a little bit into Radiolab as a podcast versus Radiolab as the syndicated mm-hmm. radio show. When did the show begin syndication to other public radio stations?
That's a good question. I think I want to say 2000, I'm going to get the date wrong, but I'm going to say a date and it's going to be wrong because I'm always wrong with dates. But I think 2006 or 7 or 8.
At the time, was it, you know, since the show is, or at least was at the time, unusual by public radio standards, was it a difficult sell to program directors?
Well, see, yes. Here's what's interesting. Initially back in the Stone Age, public radio was there's only really one way you did it on public radio, which is that you made a weekly show and then you were just on the air every single week. And so I couldn't really do that and make the kind of stories I wanted to make. And so I was making like 5-7 every like maybe 8, to be generous, every year. And so there was like a question of like, how do you sell that to a public radio station? Like, what are they going to do with 8? They're used to like 50. So it was a real like tough nut to crack. And what we finally figured out, the person I was working at the time with, Ellen Horn, she figured out, like, she was from a marine biology background. And so in her world, Shark Week was this huge thing. Where, do you know Shark Week, where they have like 5 days of
the Discovery Channel? Right.
Exactly. So everybody in the marine biology world would like take their vacations on Shark Week so they could just watch shark stuff. And she was like, why don't we do Shark Week, where we take 5 or 6 of these hours and we package them and we literally call it Shark Week, and we'll sell it to public radio stations as like, you can play one every day or one a week. Or let's say Terry Gross goes on vacation, which she does every so often, you can play a whole week of them, and then that gives you some new content while she's on vacation. And that simple move of calling it Shark Week and bundling it that way made all the difference. And then suddenly, like, public radio program directors were like, oh, I get it. I see how I can use this thing. And so, like, that was the beginning of Radiolab, really, is we started distributing it that way. And we did that for years and years, maybe 3-4 years. I'm not sure how long. And we'd do two of them, 2 Shark Weeks a year. And then it's funny, at a certain point, everybody else in the public radio system caught on to that. And then suddenly everybody was doing Shark Week. And so you had like all these new shows. Initially, I think Snap Judgment was doing it that way.
Wait, but they weren't really, were they all Shark Week?
Well, they didn't call it that, but they were doing like seasons of 5 is how they thought of it. So we sort of pioneered this like little mini season model. And we were just thinking about like HBO and like and Discovery. And like, so we were riffing off of TV at that point. So everybody else starts doing that. And by that point, Radiolab had been around for a while. We had 40 or so hours. And so then we went back to the public radio stations and we were like, well, why don't you take these 40 hours and just air them in a kind of stream? And then we'll turn ourselves into a weekly show. And so now that's what we are on the radio, is we're a weekly show. But all the while, like, we're actually mostly a podcast at this point. And so it's interesting. Our podcast self and our radio self have become very different. I mean, it's the same content more or less, but we're making – the whole team is producing stories for the podcast that we then, like, say 6 months later, we'll take like 2 or 3 of those stories and wrap them up into an hour and put it on the radio. But the radio audience is hearing a completely different thing every week than the podcast audience.
And when you're creating the show, you're primarily thinking about the format for the podcast, it sounds like, not for the radio. 100%. The radio is much more derivative than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it's evolved, is that I'm not actually thinking about the radio anymore. I'm thinking, okay, so like, how can I tell this story? At what length can I tell it? And as soon as it's ready, we'll put it out. And then the next thought, like, you know, weeks later is, okay, how do we take this story and that second story and cut 10 minutes from this one, 6 minutes from that one, put them together, make a 58-minute, 59-second radio hour? Where do we put the breaks? And where does the underwriting go and all that kind of stuff? But all those are like secondary questions. It really begins like with like thinking about that podcast listener who's like walking down the street. And what are they going to listen to, and how do you serve that person?
And how do you think the podcast has contributed to the success of the Radiolab brand?
I think it's made all the difference, frankly. That's just how it feels to me. I mean, obviously the radio, the audiences are about the same size, I think. It's hard to sort of measure either. But there's something about Radiolab that's always been hard on the radio, in my opinion. Because, like, I hear us when we come on the radio and, like, I'm doing the dishes and the kids are screaming and there's things happening between you and the radio and you're trying to pay attention to 4 things. And this is just a hard show to listen to when you're in that mode. It's kind of like you kind of have to pay attention or else something will zip by and then you've missed it. And so I've always been a little uncomfortable with how of the fit between Radiolab and the radio, mm-hmm. even though that's how we started. But then like podcasting came along and it's a totally different thing. You know, you're in a person's ears and it's just you and them, and they can hit stop or they can pause or they can rewind. And I obviously don't expect them to do that, but like they're much more in control of the situation and it's way more intimate. So I don't know. I just think we sound different on the podcast. Like all the stupid production things that we sweat make sense on the podcast. They don't make quite as much sense on the radio.
And when you're thinking about creating your show and you're imagining that guy walking down the street with his earbuds in listening to your podcast, are you ever specifically tailoring, you know, your soundscapes to sound great on headphones? You know, your show is so sonically rich. Do you hide things in the mix that you can really only detect using earbuds?
I mean, maybe, but not unintentionally. I mean, I mix on headphones, which is something most people say you should never do. But I mix on headphones just because that's how people listen. So yeah, when you're doing stuff, like we do a lot of like really dense, thick, lush soundscapes where, you know, you look at these sessions and there's like 48 tracks going, you know, you're trying to get it dense and lush so that when it's in your ears, it literally takes over your brain, mm-hmm. you know? Like you're trying to just own the person you're listening to, that's listening to you. And so, yeah, you're putting stuff in that like contributes to that and you hope people notice. I don't expect anyone to like nerd out about it or to like notice it necessarily, but you're trying to create an effect that's completely immersive. Mm-hmm. And so you can do that way more effectively on the podcast because you literally are in people's heads. You know, you're in their ear canal. And so you can put a lot more thought and labor into it.
You said that the radio audience is about the same size as the podcast audience. Do you get a sense that they engage differently? I know that you said that, you know, the listening experience is probably different, right? But like the way that they then maybe provide feedback to you, is there an audience that seems more engaged with the show?
Yeah, I mean, the podcast audience is much more engaged. I mean, a lot of the podcast consumers are actually online as they're listening. So like something's going on that they want to talk about with you, they'll let you know that pretty instantly. So when we release podcasts, I mean, you get feedback like the moment you hit send on that episode. On the radio, it just kind of happens more diffuse. You'll hear one or two comments coming through from the individual stations, but the stations are the people who hear it and they sometimes let you know and they sometimes don't. Mm. So when you put stuff on the radio, it can feel a little bit like going into the ether. Like you don't actually hear it land. On the podcast, you definitely hear it land. You know, you put it up on the site fills with comments. It's generally that you hear from the negative comments first. So like if you screw up, you hear about it.
Yeah.
If you really hit it out of the park, you hear about it. And it's pretty instantaneous. So yeah. And I would guess, although I can't back this up, I would guess that the audiences are really separate. Like they're actually different.
Demographically, you mean?
Yeah, demographically different people. And I'm fairly certain that the radio audience is older and that the podcasting audience is much younger. Mm-hmm. But I can't say that for sure. But yeah, they seem to me very separate, culturally very separate.
And, you know, on this show, we almost always talk at least a little bit about podcast ads because it's something that, you know, we focus on here at Midroll. Your show has ads, of course. Mm-hmm. Are you involved in that side of the business? Do you engage with WNYC on sort of like, how's the show doing from a revenue perspective? What can we do to improve revenue? Is that something that's a part of your world?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not the central thing I think about, but, over the last couple of years, and again, this might be what's changed in our world of podcasting is that I'm much more aware of what our underwriting and sponsorship team is up to than I was in the past. And that also goes true for our membership team, which is about like the, you know, getting listener donations. Mm-hmm. 'Cause you know, our revenue is a blend of all those things.
Yeah.
But, we now have host red spots, which for a long time we didn't. You know, that was something that the ground has been shifting and now we do that. And
were
so,
you resistant to it?
I don't know if I would say resistant, but it just wasn't like our editorial guidelines for a long time were to have a very clear and present distinction between editorial and sponsorship. Mm-hmm. That was really important on the radio. I think it's still important that people really, really trust you and they feel like you're independent and that what you say they can trust. But those same practices are just different on the podcast. And so we changed as the industry was changing. And so now it's something that we do. And I think it's fine. I think it's totally great. And I think that the people who listen get it. Like, they get that the people who are advertising with us are just helping to support this thing. I'm asked to read ads a lot and I do it. Mm-hmm. Most of our ads are still read by our listeners.
I want to talk about that too.
And I think that's a thing that listeners really like. They like hearing themselves read the ads.
How is that process coordinated?
It's funny. It's not the easiest process to deal with. I mean, this is something I'm not directly involved in, but one of our producers, Ariane, we have this app that allows us to put out a call to people. Mm-hmm. And so we can ping all of our app users. And then in the app, they can record sponsorship messages. And so, so-and-so out there will get a little message saying, hey, record this thing. They'll go into the app and then they can submit it to us because we have SoundCloud built into the app. Uh-huh. And so what she'll do, like, weeks ahead of time, she'll be constantly sort of pinging the listeners and getting those in. And then we've got to then take that, put it in front of the advertiser to make sure that they like the voice. Sometimes they don't. And then we'll put it up. But it is a whole system that's sort of working behind the scenes to...
It's very unique. Do you know actually if advertisers are paying different rates for your reads versus the listeners' reads?
I think they might be, but I actually don't know that firsthand.
Okay. Just curious. But I think that what you guys do with your ads, the blend of, your own host read ad reads and the listeners reads is really cool and interesting.
Yeah. It was hard to sort out for a while. I mean, because there was a moment where we had listeners reading every so often, Jed and Robert would read, and then you'd have like a random host who was reading at a certain point. It was sort of a hot mess for a while, but we sorted it out just in the last 6 months or so. We're trying to keep it so that, because for us, it's like really important that the ads sound like they're still of this world, like mm-hmm. they're not just something that was slapped on, but they're integrated. And so for us, it was super important to hear the listeners read those ads and also to have us be able to read them in a way that still feels kind of like we're not breaking character too much. So I don't know. It's like a lot of stupid, small like problems have to get solved, but I feel like we're figuring it out.
Shifting gears a bit, what advice do you have for maybe a young, a young podcast producer or radio producer who wants to get started and wants to emulate you?
I mean, that's a toughie. I mean, I don't know. It's like I wish someone had come along and gave me some advice. But I guess what I would say to people, it's interesting. Like, this is a really interesting moment. Like, there's all this attention being given to podcasts, and there's a sense that like people, like, this is a place where cool things are happening, which was not the case when I was coming up. So I think any advice I would have that would be directly related to my experience would probably be the wrong advice. But I guess what I would say is two things, kind of contradictory. The first, it would be like, don't wait, like, this is just like, if you have an idea and you want to do it, because you can. I mean, you can put up a podcast on SoundCloud, get it on iTunes in like a few days. I mean, that's an amazing thing. That's an amazing thing. Like, you could actually be heard so quickly. So don't wait. If you just do it. Mm-hmm. Don't wait for someone to give you permission. I mean, back in my day, there was this whole rigmarole that you had to go where you had to like convince the public radio people to put you on. You don't have to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's amazing. So my first advice would be don't wait for permission. But my second advice would be like, give it a minute. It takes a while to be successful in all the ways that count, like to have a voice that you like, to feel like you're actually doing work that you think is good, to get an audience. God knows that takes a while. Mm-hmm. Like, all the things that you want to have happen, it takes a while. So I guess that would be my advice. Don't wait, but be prepared to wait.
And for producers who are inspired by Radiolab, what other, you know, radio shows or podcasts should they listen to for inspiration?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's podcasts which I think are doing similar things, or they're in our neighborhood. I guess I could tell you about, I mean, there's, you know, 99% Invisible, there's Love and Radio. Mm-hmm. I'm really into this podcast that we have here called Meet the Composer, because I'm sort of a music nerd, and it's these sort of extended composer interviews that are beautifully sound designed. I think that's a great one. But, you know, truthfully, the podcasts that I listen to are nothing like ours.
Really?
Yeah, just because when I listen to like narrative work that's like really highly produced, it feels like work to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I start to sort of edit it in my head and I'm like, oh, stop it. Just listen. So I listen to stuff that's much more conversational. Like, I listen to a lot of comedy podcasts. Like, I love Another Round. We have one here at WNYC Studios that's going to be coming out soon called Two Dope Queens, which I really think is going to be fantastic. So I've been listening to some early stuff from them. Mark Maron, I think, is a genius. I think he actually deserves that term. I listen to him a lot. You know, I don't know. So I listen to stuff that's much more chatty and much more conversational and funny than some of the stuff that we do.
And from a content perspective, you know, Radiolab has been very much, in my opinion at least, a cutting edge show. What do you think is the cutting edge today? What shows are leading the way in really experimenting?
God, I don't know. I wish I had a good answer for you. I don't listen enough is the truth. Like, it's kind of a problem. So I don't know that I've heard it, whatever it is.
That's okay.
I definitely have heard things come out of Love and Radio where I'm like, whoa, they did that? Are they allowed to do that? Like, I've had that experience when I've listened to that that show. So they're always pushing the envelope. But God, I wish I listened to more stuff. I wish I could really answer that for you. What do you think? What do you think is really cutting edge right now?
You know, I think we're all sort of likely to look at our own stuff first. And when I think about what's cutting edge, I think some of the stuff that we're doing it with Howl. I don't know how familiar you are with Howl. It's our premium content service.
Huh.
I think we're doing some really interesting and innovative things there. We have a show called The Complete Woman, which is it's a mini series. It's a 6-part mini series, 6 15-minute episodes, where a comedian named Amanda Lund basically improvises a companion piece to a 1962 book called The Complete Woman, which is, a book that when you read it today seems, you know, incredibly misogynist and outdated. And she created a 6-part companion piece that's really well produced, really interestingly produced, and it's basically produced improv, which is something that, you know, the Superego guys do, which is also really interesting to me. Hmm. That's one I think that is pretty experimental and interesting. We also just released a series called Fruit. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that one at all, it's another mini series. It's narrative fiction. It's about a closeted NFL player, and created by Issa Rae. And I think those are a couple that come to mind immediately.
Nice. Those sound super interesting. See, yeah. You must spend a lot of your day listening.
I do. I spend a lot of my day listening.
See, I'm jealous of you. I wish I had that kind of
time. It's the fun part of the job for sure.
Yeah.
Last question for you is, you know, where do you think we are sort of in the podcast, in the spectrum of the podcast lifespan? I know you said that it's much cooler to work in mm-hmm. podcasts than it was when you started. But where do you think the industry is going?
God, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think of this in relation to the podcast bubble or whatever that was that happened 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I remember, I think, was it 2006? Was that when the first wave happened?
Yeah, or 2000, yeah, or maybe a little bit after that.
So podcasting first wave, I remember Adam, what's his name, from MTV,
got Curry.
Got a ton of press for supposedly inventing this thing. And there was a huge amount of like interest, and there was a sort of like a land rush, but it was sort of very, very short lived, and it kind of went away, and podcasting went back underground for a while. And so the first, so when we first got to like the new renaissance, just I guess in the last 2 years, with Serial and that whole thing and all the attention that was being paid, I thought to myself, okay, are we just going to go back underground again? Is that what's going to happen? But this does feel different. It feels more sustained. There's a hell of a lot more people coming into the fold. And I think more importantly, people are figuring out how to monetize it.
That's what I was going to say. There's money this time.
Yeah. And it's so, I mean, in that is the, at least the chance for this to be a sustainable thing. I don't know. I mean, I definitely have heard from a lot of people who listen to podcasts that there's just too many now and they don't have enough time and they're unsubscribing. Mm. So I don't know what that means. That just might be like anecdotes from people that I happen to bump into. But I do wonder about saturation, and I do wonder if the ad support that we're getting right now, which has been a godsend, is going to continue. Mm-hmm. I do wonder about that. And to be totally honest, Adam, I don't know what's going to happen. I hope that this thing grows and keeps growing, and that you know more diverse voices keep coming in, mm-hmm. and that the ecosystem just keeps expanding until you have like whole separate universes for different kinds of content. But I don't know. I don't know if it's going to be like that. I hope so.
Well, I guess we'll see. I don't know either, but it's going to be fun to watch and be a part of it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having you on the show, Jad. I'm a big fan of yours and your show. And I imagine that all of my listeners are very familiar with Radiolab, but listeners, if you're not, it's something you should check out immediately. Jad, where else can people find you online?
They radiolab.org would be the first place I'd go. They can check me out personally at myname.com, jadaboomrod.com. But yeah, wnyc.org as well has you can see all the other stuff we're doing here. And there's some really good things happening. So I'd visit that too.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time. Listeners, as always, subscribe to the show at earwolf.com or on iTunes. And please, if you can, rate and review the show. And until next time, happy podcasting. Thanks to all the sponsors of today's show. One more sponsor I want to mention is Howl.fm. You guys have heard me talk about it a lot already. I'm sure you've heard about it advertised on other Earwolf shows too. It's like the Netflix for podcasts. The one thing I want to talk about on this episode in particular is that we have big news, and that is that the first 30 episodes of Super Ego, one of my all-time favorite podcasts, are now exclusively on Howl Premium. Super Ego presents profiles in self-obsession that are improvised, analyzed, and delivered by doctors Matt Gourley, Jeremy Carter, Mark McConville, and Paul F. Tompkins. Super Ego features guest appearances from great comedic minds like Patton Oswalt, Jason Sudeikis, Gillian Jacobs, John Hodgman, and Julie Klausner. Get access to this exclusive content on your iPhone, Android device, and on the web for only $4.99 a month. Use my promo code WOLF and you get a full month of free trial. So go to howl.fm, use my promo code WOLF, and get one free month of Howl Premium.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Want to hear Earwolf pilots before anybody else? We made a podcast feed just for you. Earwolf Presents is full of great stuff, like preview episodes for upcoming shows, peeks behind the paywall, and pilots for podcasts that haven't even been made yet. It's like getting to listen in behind the scenes here at Earwolf. Starting January 21st, Earwolf Presents will have a bunch of new pilots for you, like Edgar Montplaisir's The Wokest. Catch conversations between the wokest man in the world and comedians like Risa Lechea. Also, hear upcoming pilots The Florida Cast, Wow, You're Native American Too?, This Week in Sports, and Carl Alarm all throughout the month. Let us know what you think of them with hashtag Earwolf Presents. Subscribe to Earwolf Presents to hear more great episodes from around the network and behind the paywall, like an episode of Drew Tarver's Strictly Business with Derek Contrera, or Act 1 of Matt Besser's punk musical, Stolen Idea. Just search for Earwolf Presents in your podcast app and subscribe so you don't miss an update.